And I say to you, my friends, when I say to you that the government of the United States compiles documentation not only upon those who are the incumbent employees of the government, but the hundreds and thousands of people who ask for employment, who are applicants. And those dossiers, those files lived to haunt the individual for years to come. And in very few instances, with the exception of the Atomic Energy Commission and the Air Force, the applicant never knows what's in the file, who made the accusations, or even the nature of the accusation. And yet that file may be available for private employment in certain key industries in this country, just as it is in government employment. I was speaking of those who administer it. These are men, we are told, who are expected to assess the intrinsic character and value of human beings in relationship, in relation to their jobs, the jobs that they hold, and from the standpoint of whether their activities in such jobs are consistent with the national interest. Their function requires not only wisdom, charity, patience, and intelligence, but also the professional skills of the lawyer, the social scientist, the social worker, the public administrator, and the psychologist, amongst others. Now, do you really think that we have this kind of men in the core of our security officers today? I think you know the answer. I speak, however, for myself. We do not. Most of the security officers today, as I understand it from our investigation, are the alumni of investigative and intelligence organizations. Now, important as their functions are, they have little in their background that trains them to make the kind and quality of decisions which are vitally important to a sound security program. Their training in their background, in all too many instances, is in the fight against evil. They are trained to look for evil, for the worst and the most evil implications of every situation. And most of what these security officers have been doing has been shrouded from public view, so it is not possible to assess and evaluate their competence. But occasionally their handiwork has blossomed forth in the public view, as in the Chasanow case and in the Ladejinsky case. And what we have seen in such cases, and I could name many more, does not inspire universal respect and confidence. As pointed out in the Hoover Commission's task force report on personnel and civil service, security determinations are not sufficiently judicial in character to make for valid decisions, says the task force. And there is fear that honest and loyal employees can be destroyed by unsupported or trivial charges, that security officers can be stampeded, and that security charges sometimes mask political removals. There's a grave danger, too, of establishing within the government service a permanent corps of security officers whose affirmative qualifications for this important job are questionable, as I have indicated, and who generally lack the qualifications which thoughtful people might think they should possess. We are all aware of the tendency, you know, of the bureaucracy to perpetuate itself. But we can, on the other hand, we can, on one hand, rejoice in the knowledge that the job of investigation and clearance of incumbent employees is almost completed, and that very shortly the security function will be concerned primarily with applicants. Now, I should like to discuss with you the manner in which this security program is administered, discussing certain symptoms which strongly suggest the operation of the program is not all that it should be. I think you clearly understand that I believe we should have a government security program. I am not advocating abolition. I am advocating that it be improved, revised, reconstructed along the lines that my remarks indicate. Now, if we're to rely upon the public statements of government officials with primary responsibilities in connection with the operation of the security program for the evaluation of that program, we would be forced to accept the view that the security program is operating smoothly, serenely, and without any need for substantial improvement. I say this after listening to the witnesses of the government of the United States. The Assistant Attorney General, who is in charge of the Internal Security Division of the Department of Justice, and the division, which apparently has basic responsibility in connection with the security program, tells us and told the subcommittee, of which I was chairman, that the program itself is sound and that the difficulties revealed in publicized cases of the past several months have not been caused by basic defects in the executive order or the law, but rather are merely, quote, a result of administration, end quote. He agrees that the security program to date has not been perfect, but minimizes the significance of this lack of perfection by pointing out, quote, that even courts of law make erroneous decisions, end of quote. Now, I'm tempted at this point to dwell at length on the analogies, or the lack thereof, between security proceedings and judicial proceedings, but I shall restrain myself. I would only respectfully suggest that an assistant attorney general should be fully aware of the rules of evidence and the true meaning of due process of law. The chairman of the Civil Service Commission, who also has important responsibilities under the security program, tells us that in his view, quote, the application of this program in terms of uniformity and equality of decision that has been made has been excellent, end quote. He too thinks the program has gone exceedingly well. Indeed, the security program has been running so well that in view of certain government officials, any public criticism and scrutiny of the program is taboo, superfluous, and unpatriotic. Those who criticize details of the present program or urge improvements have been linked by supposedly responsible government officials with a communist effort to hamstring security. I run that risk tonight in my remarks, and I run the risk knowingly and confidently that it is without truth or fact. Now, is this program as good and as well administered as we are led to believe in the self-satisfied assurances of some government officials? I think not. I'm being a little inaccurate, however, when I say that I'm discussing the security program. There is no security program. There is a mass of security programs, as many programs as there are agencies, and as separate and distinct as there are department and agencies. There is no uniformity. There is no coordination. There is no continuity of procedure. It operates, to be sure, under a uniform standard, supposedly uniform categories of derogatory information and so-called minimum standards of procedures. But all of these standards are so vague as to be meaningless, and in actual practice, they are almost infinite variations. Let me be specific. Does not a gulf of almost infinite breadth separate the security standards of the State Department under Mr. Scott McCloud, who reviewed the Ladejinsky case file and saw no question of security risk, from the standards of his counterpart in the Department of Agriculture, who reviewed the same file on the same man within the same year and saw a dangerous degree of security risk? Adding to this confusion is the subsequent retraction of the Secretary of Agriculture and his apology to Mr. Ladejinsky. But despite the apology, despite the retraction, the record in the government of the United States still labels Mr. Ladejinsky as a grave security risk, end of quote. And yet this man at this very night, and I know him intimately, has a critical and vital assignment in one of the most sensitive areas of the world in behalf of the government of the United States, namely South Vietnam. Does not a gulf of almost infinite breadth separate the security standards of the Assistant Attorney General, who is primarily responsible for interpretation of the executive order, and who says this order does not apply to occupants of non-sensitive positions concerning whom there is derogatory information as to character and habits, from the security standards of numerous other agencies of the government who stated publicly and before the committees of Congress that they have consistently exercised the authority under the security program in dismissing such non-sensitive employees because of derogatory information about their character and habits. Now, the divergencies in actual procedures are even more striking. It is almost incomprehensible to me how anyone can say, as did two very prominent government officials, that there is relatively uniform application in the security program. It is not completely incomprehensible, I must confess, Because if I learned anything at all in our hearings, it is that no one in the government really knows or is sufficiently interested in what is going on in the security program beyond the point of his own department or his own nose. Every official wraps himself up in his own security responsibilities, defined as narrowly as possible, and chants the virtues of the status quo, even though he is wholly unable to justify it, and at times does not even seem to understand it. It is readily apparent that the security program is being administered without genuine coordination of uniformity. I must confess that after hearing for several days the representatives of the government on this problem, I was completely unable, despite diligent effort, to find out what, if anything, is being done about coordination. And may I say to you that with a subcommittee of 7, 4 Democrats and 3 Republicans, all 7 agreed that there was not a scintilla of coordination. The Department of Justice suggested that the Civil Service Commission is the principal coordinator. The Civil Service Commission suggested that the Department of Justice was primarily responsible for coordination. The Department of Defense, however, apparently thinks that both the Civil Service Commission and the Department of Justice have substantially equivalent roles in this regard. In fact, the chairman of the Civil Service Commission was able to give the subcommittee considerable information about what the Assistant Attorney General is doing in the area of coordination that we were unable to extract under careful cross-examination from the Assistant Attorney General himself. Now, there is no doubt in my mind that coordination is the top secret of the security program. I detect reflections of this lack of coordination, uniformity, and consistency in some of the fragmentary statistics which have become available concerning the operation of the program. Although I'm not a very good statistician, and apparently not good at pronunciation, I think that my statistician friends will agree that in a universe of 2 million federal employees subject to the security program, scattered among 60 to 70 agencies of the government, there ought to be some statistical correlation or pattern apparent. Available figures, however, reveal no such pattern. The best statistics available are those of the Atomic Energy Commission, and I pause to say that the best example of a good security program is in the Atomic Energy Commission, and it is that commission, and it is the only department of government which is exempt from Public Law 733 and Executive Order 10450. It has its own security program. And we could learn much from it for the rest of the government. The AEC has completed since 1946 approximately 504,000 full background investigations conducted for it, the bulk of which were for applicants for AEC employment for security clearance. I think you would agree with me that the Atomic Energy Commission is a sensitive agency of the government. The AEC reports that only 494 out of 504,000 full background investigations, or just 0.1%, were actually denied clearance. When I say 0.1%, that figure applies to the total number which they had derogatory information upon out of the 500,000 plus. Less than 0.1% of all of those that they were able to obtain any derogatory information were denied security clearance. Now, we may compare these figures with an analogous data reported by the Department of State, indicating that the State Department denied employment on security grounds to approximately 1 in 4,500% of all the applicants investigated. This means that the Department of State denies security clearance in a larger percentage of cases than the Atomic Energy Commission finds even raise a security question. In other words, the Department of State found people to be either subversive or security risk in a larger number as a final decision than the Atomic Energy Commission even found derogatory information about out of 504,000 applicants. Now, there are some other interesting statistics. The Foreign Operations Administration, we've changed it since in recent days. We call it now the International Cooperation Administration, which has 2/3 as many employees as the United States Information Agency, reports that it has dismissed 184 employees for security reasons between May of 1953 and September of 1954, as compared with the United States Information Agency's report, an agency that has one-third more employees, that only two employees had been removed for this same reason within the same period. Similarly, the Department of Interior, which employs over 50,000 employees, reports that it has terminated 140 employees for security reasons, while the Department of Agriculture, with over 70,000 employees, had only dismissed 102. I say that it is difficult to find a shred of statistical correlation among the various agencies with respect to relationship between total employment and total security dismissals. A similar absence of correlation is to be found in the relationship between the number of employees listed as removed for security reasons and the number of employees who are listed as having resigned before security determination was made in cases known to involve derogatory information. For the government as a whole, from May 53 to September 1954, it is reported that 3,602 employees were dismissed for security reasons, while 5,000 resigned before security determination was completed. The Foreign Operations Administration reported that seven times as many employees were fired as resigned. The State Department, on the other hand, reported 46 times as many employees resigned as were fired. Almost the reverse, the complete opposite. Now, if these figures have any meaning at all, they must be regarded as indicating a rather astonishing variation in the resolution of security cases among the various agencies and departments. It is also astonishing that a chairman of the Civil Service Commission, a man for whom, by the way, I have a high regard, could say that there has been, quote, relatively uniform application, end of quote. Yes, I am deeply concerned that responsible officials of the United States government have evidenced far too little interest in or concern over the obvious danger signals, such as these statistical data and other evidence of poor administration reveal. The greatest tragedy of the security program is that these officials close their eyes to the facts and to constructive criticism and defend the status quo blindly, almost as a reflex action. Nor is it any answer to these criticisms or to the obvious deficiencies which are to be found to say that the security program does not, quote, stigmatize government employees, as one of our most responsible and powerful government officials so did state. Stigmatize government employees who fail to meet the tests, or to say that the individual has no right to government employment and should therefore be grateful for the scraps of procedural privileges thrown his way. And to say that security proceedings, and this we heard again and again, that security proceedings are administrative in nature and not judicial or adversary proceedings. These are the shibboleths of the security program. They are demonstrably false. I regret that time does not permit me to go in to show you that by demonstration how truly false they are. Suffice it to say that the security program has a profound and a lasting effect upon the individuals subject to it, or far over above the numbers and above the immediate effect upon their employment by the government. Individuals who fail to meet the tests of security are subject to very substantial deprivation. A responsible government should therefore exercise extreme caution, good judgment, and restraint in imposing such deprivation upon its citizens, even in the name of national security. I must report with sorrow that I have seen no indication that the officials presently responsible for the conduct of the security program have an adequate appreciation of the responsibility of our government to its citizenry in these security matters. It is because of these observations that I introduced in the Senate in January 18, 1955, Senate Joint Resolution 21. I had as my co-sponsor the junior senator from Mississippi, Mr. Stennis. This resolution called for the establishment by the Congress a special commission to study the government loyalty and security program. I am sure that you all know that after the weeks of hearings to which I have alluded, and many more weeks of executive sessions and debate in the House and in the Senate, the resolution was overwhelmingly adopted. This commission will consist of 12 members. We call it a blue ribbon commission. It is equally bipartisan, or should I say nonpartisan. It is directed to study all of the phases of government security and procedures and to submit appropriate recommendations. The president will appoint four, two from the executive branch and two from private life. The president of the Senate will appoint four, two from the Senate and two from private life. The speaker of the House will appoint four, two from the House and two from private life. The commission will, on the basis of this study, submit reports and recommendations. It is to be clearly understood, however, that the security program is not only one of reassurance that our citizens are fairly and justly treated in their dealings with the government in the field of security. Equally important, I believe, is that we have a security mechanism which will effectively protect the national security. And there is little doubt in my mind that the present program fails in that respect. Furthermore, individual rights and privileges are being grossly violated. A security program which fails to command the confidence and respect of loyal government employees, which repeatedly abridges or ignores long accepted and honored standards of due process of law, cannot succeed in providing for maximum security for a freedom-loving people. There is an urgent necessity to restore the faith of the American people in the protections guaranteed by the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, and an equally urgent necessity of eliminating for once and for all the doctrine of guilt by association. If ever there was an un-American doctrine, that is it. I summarize these remarks with these general observations. The enlarged purpose of any loyalty and security program is to protect the national security. That's a noble purpose and one to which we can all agree. To enhance the country's strength and power. In times such as these, however, a nation's strength can no longer be measured solely in terms of industrial output, planes, tanks, bombs, armies, and defense production secrets. The real strength of this nation depends in a great measure on creative ideas and the respect for and the dedication to established traditions and the great heritage of Western civilization. The free and the open mind has been our nation's most powerful resource since its infancy. Yet it is this very resource, this resource of freedom of inquiry, academic freedom, the right to dissent and to be different, that has been under severe and relentless attack. The word intellectual has been used as a rallying cry for the political bullies in our society. Some people seem to have forgotten that liberty means freedom of choice, not only in the marketplace of commodities on Main Street, but in the marketplace of ideas, yes, in colleges and universities, and on Main Street. All too often, in recent years, new ideas and unorthodox expressions have been labeled suspect. In far too many instances, there has been a failure to distinguish between disloyalty and nonconformity. The failure to do this, I respectfully suggest, is to violate the letter and the spirit of every democratic principle by which we live. It is a basic and undeniable fact that in these difficult times, when democracy has so much at stake, when we need to be ever more zealous and ever more vigilant than ever before in the preservation of the principles and the faith that has made possible a free society. But eternal vigilance, you know, is more than just a catchphrase. It is a mandate, a responsibility, a duty to a free citizenry. Eternal vigilance requires more than effective police work and apprehension of those who would engage in conspiratorial activity. It is more than a call to arms. Eternal vigilance in a free society requires building a just and strong political and social structure. Internal security, likewise, is much more than counter-espionage and rooting out of the subversives. It is internal health, a harmonious relationship between the elements of a great cosmopolitan society. It encompasses an ever-expanding and growing economy that offers opportunities for all. It means a government of the people, but a government of law administered fairly. Yes, internal security requires faith and trust in one another, not suspicion and fear. It requires a relentless struggle against every form of bigotry, intolerance, and prejudice, and the guarantee of equal treatment and fair treatment for each and every citizen. It is this part of internal security that is all too often overlooked. A society that is healthy in terms of its political and economic social institutions is one which, by its very nature, can and will resist successfully subversion. What we need, if we are to remain a land which is both free and brave, is more great men to accomplish great things. And this greatness must be of the mind and of the spirit, and not merely of the voice and the strong arm. But the mind and the spirit do not produce great deeds or even great philosophies when the mind and the spirit are surrounded and intimidated by an atmosphere of fear and suspicion. Yes, it is our present day responsibility, and we particularly have this responsibility, to reassert clearly, unequivocally, our belief in the dignity of man and all that that phrase means. To reassert our dedication to freedom of conscience and all that that means in the history of our land and our civilization. And to reestablish clearly and to reassert clearly the truth of human brotherhood. Now, these are the articles of faith of free men. These are the moral principles that have given inspiration to the creation of government by the consent of the governed, of justice under law. And I respectfully state tonight that anyone who violates these articles of faith stands guilty of being the real traitors, the real subversives, the real disloyal ones. For it is upon these great immortal principles that the American Republic has been founded, and it is around these principles that the truly great glories of Western civilization have been achieved. Thank you.